All right. Welcome to another edition. It's not Friday afternoon. It's Thursday afternoon today. Short
That's
week.
right.
It's the long weekend edition of the podcast. And I told you before we got started, I had my cheat sheet, and I totally, when I pressed my little go live, but messed everything, my perfect plans out. So we'll give it a second. All right. There we
Classic.
Go. Perfect. Back to normal. So, I guess, do you have any movie talk to this week? Is there anything you watched? Like, I don't have anything. I was trying to think of something before the stream started. I don't have any movies. I have, like, nothing.
Nothing to go for? Blood and Honey 2 is out.
Blood and Honey? Yeah, what is Blood and Honey 2?
That's the Winnie the Pooh slasher after it came into public domain. So the second one is out there if you're into that kind of thing.
All right. Yeah. Well, long weekend. Give you an extra day to catch up on your Winnie the Pooh slasher flicks.
Yeah.
It's a family movie. I know what. Speaking of movie, there was there's a Thanksgiving slasher movie.
We watched that recently.
Yeah. What'd you think of it?
It's awesome.
Okay. So see, I did think of a movie after you said slasher that popped in my head. And what made me think of it was it was on one of the socials. I don't know if it was.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. And the comment was, like, who knows if it's true or not, but sort of thread or the idea was that the family decided to watch, is it called Thanksgiving? I think it's just called Thanksgiving, right? Because it was a good family flick, but I guess the younger folks knew what it really was and the older folks in the family didn't. So they sat down had quite the surprise, I guess, that when it sort of went a little sideways. I have another good movie suggestion, and it's the complete opposite of what we just talked about. Lindsay Lohan has a new movie on I was going to say on LinkedIn. Yeah, that'd be weird.
That would be straight. That would be interesting.
On the Netflix. And we watched it. And you know what? It wasn't a bad movie. If you're just looking for some, like, fun kind of feel good, silly, like, rom-com kind of stuff, just chill.
Yeah.
Both my wife and I kind of walked away and went, you know what? That wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be. It was kind of fun. It's a good long weekend with your family movie. People would, I think everybody would find something that they would enjoy.
Well then. Remember when it was dull?
It's called Irish Wish, I think.
Oh, okay. They must have released that for St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah. That was the best. I looked over. I'm like, did I just, like, lose your connection? I'm like, I bet you Irish Wish must be up on your list by that reaction.
Oh, it's on my list now for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You can do it for movie night. I'm sure everybody will love it. All right. So enough movie talk. Let's get into the first stuff of the week. And here you go. This is the default to set up version 2 of IMDS for all of your new instances. So it won't affect existing instances. Finally, right? Now, you know what? As you say, finally, I kind of was under the impression that this was enabled by default when you were using newer instance types or classes. Like if I went in and deployed, I don't know, this generation of a Graviton processor or something like that. I don't know if I'm making this up
T4G
or not, but I thought it was, T4G or something. I thought it was turned on already. But regardless, this is, I think, another one of those kind of quality of life type things and something you should probably turn on from day one, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because we still I ran into this last week. I was looking at a customer account. They have a Kubernetes cluster that runs on T2 nodes that is freshly set up, right? So if you can set this up into your account, it's a good default setting. It's more secure than IMDS version 1, right? So
Yeah. And it does say in here, and we had a good chuckle about this, or I did at least. Let's see here. Somewhere in here, it says a single API call, which is fantastic, but damn if I could find that single API. Oh, right here. Defaults with a single API call per region. But damned if I could find what that API call was until I until I messaged you in Slack. And then as soon as I hit enter, I went back to the doc and I was like, oh, damn, there it is.
So oh, right.
just to save everybody a little bit of time, at least from the Botto side of things, the API is modify instance metadata defaults. Just a
right.
Bit of a mouthful, but it really is that easy. So what I did was I was setting up a series of new accounts for a customer, and we have a whole bunch of scripts that we run when we set up those accounts, right? To do things like default encryption on EBS volumes and all those kinds of good things. Yeah. And I just added this to the list, and it literally took me 2 minutes to add the little chunk of code. I used Code Whisperer to help me with a little bit, although it didn't know the API call because it's so brand new, but
I'd been trained on it, right?
Yeah. It threw the chunk of code that I needed in the Python script, and I just kind of went back and filled it in. And within a couple minutes, I had this deployed into 8 new accounts that we had set up for a customer that weren't in use yet. So I figured, hey, might as well just put this in from the beginning. So I think this is a good one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
And yeah, you know, I don't know about this one, but I like Compute Optimizer. So, and Compute Optimizer is kind of one of those things, if you're running lots of EC2-based applications or EC2-based workloads in your environment, using the Compute Optimizer to kind of help you understand, are you using the right instance types and sizes, is good because it can help you, well, right-size your environment and, well, just reduce some of your spend. So the fact that it supports a bunch of new instance types.
That's great.
Not bad, yeah, right?
Yeah, it's something that doesn't hurt to look at, right? Like, you can reduce your bill substantially depending on if you've over-provisioned your workloads or not, right? So it's definitely worth taking a look at. And there's also the tie-in, like if you reduced EC2 spend, you also reduce carbon footprint if you're interested in that too, so.
Which we all should be, right?
Yeah.
You know, do what you can to reduce the carbon footprint's always good. And then I guess the other thing we should say about Compute Optimizer is just remember it does more than just EC2. So this is an EC2 update for Compute Optimizer. But what else does it do? It does Lambda, does...
And ECS, I think.
ECS, it does EBS too, doesn't it? Doesn't it look at your EBS volumes and...
Yeah, I think it'll look at the provision throughput. Yeah.
Yeah. So it does more than just EC2, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, this it's just... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the over-provisioned instances are just waste, essentially, right? Like, you're spending for nothing, so.
Yeah, and I guess just on that theme is this isn't sort of a one-and-done type thing, right? It's something that you should be looking at on a regular basis just to make sure that, because things are going to change in your environment. You might have people working on those EC2 instances. Mm-hmm. You might be supporting the infrastructure and things change. So, you know, having this running in your environment and something that you regularly look at is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Anything else I want to say about this one? Oh, it supports organizations. So I would kind of say enable Compute Optimizer for all of the accounts in your organization. And there are two versions of it, right? There's the free version of Compute Optimizer.
Right.
There's the paid version. So if you do go down the paid version path, as always, make sure you understand the pricing model before you turn it on. So.
But the free version is pretty good. It'll give you the basic.
Are we using the paid version anywhere?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
It's kind of like the IP address analyzer situation, right? Like the default is good enough for you to get by with. It gives you the information you need anyways.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I don't think we've ever turned on the paid version. The paid version gives you more metric data for longer time period, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's a longer horizon. I think, what is it, 2 weeks for the default?
Yeah. That's the number that comes to mind for me, because normally that's pretty much the default that Amazon uses for everything, right? Is that sort of 2 week thing. So,
right.
But anyways, you know what?
Yeah.
If you don't have it turned on, you probably should turn it on. And especially if you're running, you know, EC2 based workloads, it makes a lot of sense. And I know, as much as we talk about Gen AI and all the cool serverless stuff, most of our customers are running a ton of EC2 instances. So
still need servers, right?
Still need servers, right? So yeah, this is a good one. Let's see. Here we go. This kind of goes along. I should have saved this one to the end of the... Sorry, I got Zoom issues. There we go. So blueprints here to help you build out your chatbot solutions faster. using Code Catalyst. I don't know. I think this is interesting, but I have kind of a mixed thought about it. Do you have anything you want to say about this one before I kind of give you the contrarian view of it?
To be honest, I haven't really looked at Code Catalyst that much. So it's not particularly exciting for me, but I mean, if it helps you deploy it quicker, then all the more power to you, I suppose.
Yeah. And see, that kind of leads into what I was going to say is using blueprints and stuff like that to deploy stuff faster is great. Just the thing that I always find troubling about this kind of stuff, but what I would just caution is make sure you understand what it is that you're doing before you do this stuff. Like the blueprints make it easy, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to do what you want. So you have to understand the cost implications, security implications. And I think the thing that always gets me about these is it's great to have a blueprint if you're really comfortable with this stuff, but you're probably better off spending a little bit of time upfront to actually learn it and understand what it's going to do. And then, by all means, use blueprints, but just don't deploy something because you can.
Sure. Yeah. No, it pays to have an understanding of what you're actually working with.
And I threw this one in here just because we spend a lot of our time talking about Gen AI. So when I was going through the never-ending scrolling list of updates, I was like, hey, let's put this one in here. So that's that. This one did catch my eye. So there had been a lot of updates to Code Build lately, right? There was a couple things a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And this one particularly grabbed my attention because we use GitLab for everything. We use, I guess, self-managed implementations of GitLab.
Right.
For, pretty much everything that we do, whether we're managing them or it's in a customer's account. So having the ability to tie that to Code Build really caught my attention. So I thought this was a good one.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, right? Like, so we can pipe from GitLab into Build if we need to run any, maybe build a container or something like that. Yeah. So yeah, that's worth playing with, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And sort of what caught my attention with this is like, if you're running standalone self-managed GitLab runners in your account,
right?
In theory, again, those could be Docker containers. They could be running on a containerized platform like ECS or something like that. But in our experience, a lot of times those are just running on EC2 instances, probably because that's what most people are comfortable with. So then you've got the cost associated with that runner sitting on an EC2 instance that, let's be honest, is probably not running all the time, but you've got that EC2 instance sitting there. So with this and Code Build, more of a managed approach, you basically are going to stand up that Code Build environment when you need it, which, depending again on what you've got running for your runners in your environment, could help you reduce your cost. And it definitely would reduce the amount of time you spend managing those things.
Oh, right? For sure.
Because you don't have an operating system to deal with.
Yeah, we might be able to use this to save on some GitLab costs for sure.
That's kind of what grabbed my attention was, hey, this is just to be able to have this type of integration, another option that you have. But I immediately had the same thought. Like, I was thinking about a couple of the environments that we have that have those standalone runners running on EC2 instances. I can think of two or three scenarios that Code Build actually might make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be hard to take your CI scripts from GitLab and just translate them into your CI scripts that you're going to use for Code Build because...
No, sure. It's relatively comparable, right? Like it's not too complicated to do that.
It's not exact, but the idea is if you've built a CI script in GitLab, you're in a very short period of time going to be able to translate that into, I know it's not called a CI script in Code Build. It's isn't it just called a build file that you include?
I think so. Yeah.
It's a build YAML file or something, right? It's not going to take you a lot of effort to translate that into something you could use in Code Build. So that was a good one.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, more Gen AI stuff. I think this is, did you add this one? I can't remember now.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. This is adding knowledge bases for Cloud 3, right? Okay. Yeah. So this is just essentially knowledge bases in Bedrock now supports the latest and greatest Cloud model, right? That's available for general use. So there you go.
Yeah.
About it.
You know what? Like, this will be a nice tie into some of the other sort of non-AWS updates that we have coming up here. But I've been raving about Claude and Sonnet now for, it feels like, weeks. I was using it again this morning, and I'm like, how the hell is this working? The other thing that I'll talk about it as we get into one of these other articles, but I think there's another model that I want to try just to compare to this, but, I'll save that for now. But I guess this idea of knowledge bases, and being able to, I'm going to use the word augment the LLM with your own information to help it answer very specific types of questions. This is always good. Right. Oh, and one last sort of AWS related thing. Kudos. So I don't remember what Kudos stands for. But
cost and usage dashboard, I think.
Is it?
I don't know. I don't remember what the OS is.
Yeah.
Organizational.
It works. Let's go with that. We're deploying this right now for a customer. And the reaction that we had from that customer is, wow, like, holy crap, there is a ton of info in here. And I won't pick on any sort of particular platform, but their immediate reaction was, well, then why am I spending money over here, monthly percentage of bill? Why don't I just use this? And,
sure.
And I'm speculating here, but I would suspect the existing tool might be on thin ice looking at what this thing can do. And last week they updated the dashboards. So they're version 5.3 of the dashboards. We were running, we did the first implementation, and I think we were running 5.2. So it wasn't a big update for us.
Oh, sure.
But you can see all the new dashboards that they added. And of course, there's AI and ML stuff in here, new compute info. So this was just timely as I was thinking about this other project that we were working on.
So it seems pretty solid in terms of dashboards. Like, there's a couple of companies out there that have pretty much just managed dashboard solutions for AWS costing and billing, right? I'd be worried.
I'd be worried. Yeah. This is, you know, from my perspective and been working in this space for a really long time now, this is like AWS normal operating procedure is, hey, let's just build something that's going to be effective, that's going to cost less than some of the tools that are out there. I've seen them do this a bunch of times. The one thing that I would say about the Kudos dashboard, it can be a little overwhelming. I'm going to call it the foundation, like maybe a better word would be the base dashboard. Okay. And then on top of that, you've got additional dashboards that you can add. Even in the base dashboard, wow, like there is a ton of shit in there. And then if you add those additional dashboards, and then as Amazon continues to update and add more of these, I could see how it might be a little overwhelming, but once you kind of get used to it and you kind of figure out, you know, the info that makes sense to you and know where to find it, I think you'll be okay, but it might be a little overwhelming at the very beginning.
Okay. Is it customizable at all? I haven't had the chance to read.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking of that as I was on my soapbox there about how it's a little overwhelming. I don't really know, to be honest. I'd be shocked if it wasn't. Like, when we did this, Amazon has a whole set of CloudFormation templates and some scripts that you can use to deploy the whole thing. We made a lot of changes to those CloudFormation templates, so it did take us, I think, a little bit longer, but we also used it as a learning exercise for some new folks on the team. But, you know, I don't know about the actual, like, you're thinking about, could I, as an example, I don't have any AI or ML tools right now. So why do I need those dashboards? Yeah. Like, thinking kind of, how do you remove those? I'd be shocked if you could do it, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
Yeah. So
take a look at them.
Yeah. You know what? If you're running something in AWS and you want to have a really great picture of what you have in the environment, and it does more than just cost and usage. Like, there's a trusted advisor integration, there's a compute optimizer, integration. There's a ton of stuff here. So it's worth a little bit of time and effort. And they give you some cost calculations. There's a whole sort of, it's the word I'm looking for, like a workshop that you can follow step A through step, step one through step N.
Yeah.
You can follow it all through. Pretty simple to get deployed. And they give you a cost estimate as well. But there's obviously a lot of factors there, but it'll give you an idea of what you're going to spend. And what I liked about it isn't, it's not a percentage of your spend. It's just how much services you're consuming to do it. So,
right. Yeah.
So that's always good.
That can be a huge deal.
It adds up, right? It's kind of one of those things where it's cheap at the beginning, but if you continue to build out your environment and add more and more stuff, that percentage spending could be significant, right? So that's the AWS portion of the show. I'm sure we've missed a lot of stuff here, but these are the things that jumped out at us over the week. So some things you can learn about. Let's change gears and talk about the Gen AI portion of the show.
All right.
I know last week we said we'd maybe flip this around, but didn't happen this week. We'll see what happens next week. So this is the first article, and you and I were talking before we got started, and I said, I really like this article on Vox, and make sure you read it. And I reread it, and the second time I read it, I was kind of like, maybe I was tired when I read this article. Did you manage to get through this one before?
I did. I got through it.
Okay, you tell me what you think.
Okay. It's called How AI Could Explode the Economy and How It Could Fizzle. So he kind of walks through how the economic growth rate in human society for the past 100 years has been about 2.2%, and how there's potential for the growth rate to explode to about 20 to 30% with all of this automation, this AI stuff. And he kind of goes over the potential pitfalls of that and what could happen to not cause that explosive growth. I mean, it's interesting, right? He has some good points about bottlenecks in the economy. Like, one of the ideas is there are some sectors that are not as amenable to easy automation, and that's what slows down overall growth. It's interesting. What did you think about it?
So when I read it the second time, after I told you this was an awesome article, and I'm like, I sat down and read it again. And you know what? My take was, it could explode the economy, or the economy could fizzle. So I read this, and it's not a short article, right? It's nowadays with everybody's short attention spans, this is a long article. There's a lot of words in here that you're going to have to force yourself to read. The second time through it, I was kind of like, so aren't you just saying it could go this way, or it could go the exact opposite way? So we don't really know.
That's right.
So it's kind of felt the second time through that this is one of those articles that's just meant, because it says AI, people are going to read it. In the end, it really doesn't tell you much of anything. I don't know.
I think there's some good points in here about the specific industries and the kind of tasks that, like, if you can get, okay, so there's this idea that automation in the past has been pretty narrow generally in its applications. Like, you build a machine to do a specific thing, like a loom, for example.
Yeah.
And that has great growth for that specific task, but it's really narrow. But the idea is, if you have a more general purpose kind of system, then what you get is broadly applicable growth across many fields, right? So that's kind of the idea of where that explosive growth could come from. I think that there's something to that. And especially, he also talks about R&D being automated.
Which we have talked about a couple times in previous episodes, right?
And that's something I've seen a lot in the talk about this kind of stuff, is if you can automate kind of research and development for various fields as a process, like if you can automate doing science, the growth potential, like that flywheel is kind of, you can imagine, right? Like, that is explosive.
Yeah, that is. Yeah. So but, a couple other things with this is, you know, I've kind of gone on both ends of the spectrum on this one. Like the first time it came, like I said, I loved it. And then when I read it again after we talked today, I was like, but two things kind of jump out at me here is that this is kind of like the discussion we've had about technology since the beginning of technology, right? Like it's going to change the world. It never really, I would argue that it's going to be an extreme. I don't really think it has, right? Like it's changed our day-to-day lives in significant ways. But when you look back at movies and how people interpret what technology would do, we're really nowhere close to that in real life. And most people have jobs and stuff like that. The thing that I kind of struck me about this is, as I thought about it a little bit more, is this probably will take, again, this idea of how technology will change the world to the extreme. Like you're either going to be benefiting from this change exponentially. And that's one of the things he says, right? He says like, you know, there's going to be people that are going to be insanely well off versus like sort of today's technology sort of well off standards. And then there's going to be a whole bunch of people and a lot more, right? People that are just going to be left behind. And I think the thing that, the thing that kind of struck me with this is there's really no in between. It's feast. It feels like feast or famine to me. You're going to do really well or you're not going to. So that's kind of the one thing that struck me. I don't know. What do you think?
I feel like there's room for something in the middle there. Yeah. Like it, I don't know if you're ever going to get to like a perfectly human free automated system in a lot of these cases, right? That's the one thing that we see a lot, like even all these new development tools, they're not perfect, right? They're statistical in nature a lot of the time. So they're going to have outliers, right? And there's some issues with creativity and processes. So for research and development, that can be a problem. A lot of the generated content can get pretty samey as it comes from an average of the internet, right?
You know what? Now, just you made me think of something as you said that. So we've talked about this person in the past on the show. Her name is Allie Miller. I think I mentioned her maybe last week or the week before. And she posted something on LinkedIn. And she was saying about, it's funny, as soon as somebody pointed this out, I was like, oh my God. So she's like, we made a GPT that started filtering words that AI uses all the time, people don't use in real life. And the word was delve.
Delve.
We're going to delve into this. And it's so funny. I was like, okay, yeah, that's interesting, right? My first take was more, hey, this is just an article again about how you can use AI and customize it for what you need. I ran something through. I don't know what I was doing. And like in the first sentence, there's the word delve. And it made me laugh. I was like, it's kind of like when you get a new car and you're like, I'm the only one with this car until you get it. And then you're like, there's one.
Yeah.
It's everywhere, right? So it kind of made me laugh. The other thing about this article made me think of a book that I read years ago. Let me see. I pulled it up while we were talking. I pulled it up on Amazon. I want to see, does it tell me when this was published? I can't remember. 2009 was the first edition. So that's like a lifetime ago in technology land, right? It's called Makers, and it's by Cory Doctorow. Is there a little subtitle on this guy? I think there is. Let me see if I can find its subtitle. A novel of the whirlwind changes to come. This is still a really relevant book. Now, in this book, they're not talking about AI particularly, at least not to my recollection. I'll have to read this again now that I'm thinking about it. But it's talking about how technology essentially is going to do a lot of the things that I think I'm maybe more pessimistic than you are about, where like there's just going to be this huge sort of swath of people that just, you know, are having challenges. And this book is all kind of about how two people sort of are using technology to do certain things, but the economy itself has just been decimated because of the changes of technology, the changes due to technology. It's a really cool book. If you're into tech and you're into kind of what could the future hold, 2009, what's that? That's like do the math. 15 years ago?
15 years ago.
I needed Code Whisperer. Tell me what's the difference in years. My brain couldn't think of that. It's a long time ago, right? But it just made me think of it as I was thinking about this article. So it's worth a read if you're into kind of like technology books and stuff. It's kind of fun.
No, for sure. And they kind of go into that in this article too, right? They talk about how once you get more automation in a field, kind of it crushes the market for labor in that field. So it shrinks it as part of the overall economy type. And that's kind of the effect of that.
Yeah.
It pushes people into other sectors. So.
Yep. I like this one. NVIDIA could be primed to be the next AWS.
For sure.
Yeah. The gist of this article is the way I interpret it was that AWS, Amazon Web Services, kind of was the first company in the cloud space where they realized they could rent their idle compute and storage and all that stuff to other people. And they had a lead. They had a head start where they were the only ones doing it. And the premise of this article is that NVIDIA kind of is in the same situation that AWS was 10, 15 years ago, whatever the math is there, that they were making these GPUs for a completely different purpose originally, right? And then how that we've just realized that GPUs are really great at doing this other thing that we really want to do a lot of. And you can see here in the second paragraph, moving from $7.1 billion in Q1 of 2024 to $22 billion, estimated, obviously, Q4 of 2024. So
absurd.
Yeah, it's insane. So this is, it's not a long article, but I thought it was interesting. And I like the analogy that the author drew between sort of the possibility of NVIDIA having that same sort of experience that, that AWS had and benefited from for a long time. Right. So, neat.
They could just go direct and start their own GPU hosting services. Right. I think they're doing that with their APIs for,
The ones that we talked about last week. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if that's what they do. Right. It would make sense. They're the ones with all the GPUs, so why not rent them instead of selling them to somebody? Yeah, I don't know. I guess in the end, it'll all even out because, in the article, they talk about how, growth in AWS has slowed, but we're also talking about growth on astronomically large numbers. So it will be a smaller percentage than it might have been in the past. So you'll probably see the same thing here over time as the other big tech companies develop their own processing power and stuff like that. And
we'll
see it kind of even out. But yeah, I guess for the foreseeable future, they'd have a significant advantage, right? Just because they happen to be making these chips that become
they're so top important. Of the line, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. And then last article for today. And I actually made notes on this one. Normally I can keep my thoughts in my head on most of the articles. I can, as I kind of look at the article, I'm like, yeah, I can remember that stuff. This is fantastic. And it is about the ways that enterprises are changing how they're using Gen AI, whether they're building it or buying it. And I won't go through the article, but I'll just mention a couple sort of summary notes here as I flip through it. First off, the budget thing here. Budgets are obviously growing. You can see here sort of, this is based off of interviews that they did with, 70 Fortune 500 companies, I think, if I recall, right over the last 6 months. So sort of how they're...
This is their spend.
Yeah. So... Yeah, like sort of what they're doing. And the interesting thing that I noticed right away in this piece is, first off, sort of... budgets are growing, but it's also the different ways that they're using, like how they're spending their money. So somewhere in the article, it said something along the lines like when all of this activity first started, organizations were using like their innovation budgets, where it was just like kind of a one-time thing. Let's go out and try this out. And now they're starting to see as they were interviewing these folks, how they're sort of taking those. It's actually here, this piece, number two. So taking them from those sort of one-time expenditures, maybe where you would want to go out and just, well, try something, into sort of regular sort of budgets that are recurring over time. So it's interesting to see that it's growing and organizations are kind of shifting on how they want to pay for it.
Okay. Gotcha. So they're reprioritizing budgets from other sectors, it looks like.
Yeah.
Like business units, net new IT budget.
Yeah, kind of the way I, right? You can see budget allocation here, right? How they're kind of handling it. Now, this I don't think is unique to Gen AI. Measuring ROI is still an art and a science. Like the gist here is just trying to figure out what are the metrics that make sense to measure your return on investment for the dollars you're investing into Gen AI. And you can see here, they pointed out a couple things. Customer satisfaction metrics like NPS scores. There were a couple other things. I think my recollection of this, I obviously didn't make good enough notes for this. My recollection of this is in a lot of cases, they're still measuring ROI on cost savings. There's somewhere here in the article where they're like, hey, we were able to save X amount of dollars for every customer support call that we got by using Gen AI. And we talked about that a couple of weeks ago too, I think, right? Just how it's going to just sort of, what's the word I want to use here? Like gut certain jobs, I think. And that's a good example.
Yeah. Like the tech support industry, for example, or the call center industry. Yeah.
Yeah. And somewhere somewhere in this article, they talk about sort of some easy metrics that organizations were using, pure cost savings, but now sort of going forward, what is it that how are they going to measure?
It's kind of funny that 56% are thinking, yes, it's worth it, but we don't really know exactly how worth it. They don't have any.
We don't actually know how to measure it. We just feel it's right, but there's no numbers to back it up. Which sometimes gives me a little bit of pause over all of this. Like, is this just another one of those technology things? I don't think it is, but it is, to your point, a little shocking. 56% of people believe that this is good, but have no way to measure it. And then here's the other one that I was mentioning, focused on cost savings. So just measuring 31% of people who responded said, we're just looking at cost savings for now, which does remind me of early days in AWS as well, even, right? And just cloud. Yeah. Like when we first started this a long time ago, most of the conversations we had were cost savings. Like it was
that's
like
the value prop, right?
Yeah. It's like if it costs me $100 to run it on-prem and you're going to tell me it's going to cost me $101 to run an AWS, why would I do it? And you can see how the cloud business has evolved over time, where obviously cost is still really important, but now we think more about sort of efficiency and time to market and stuff like that. And I would assume that as this matures, you'll see that sort of same thing happen, right?
Oh, sure.
What else did I say? This is another one. You can draw a lot of parallels here. My summary for this whole thing is finding talent is hard. I think that goes without saying, especially for something as new as this, right?
Yeah.
And again, this, you could draw parallels to early cloud adoption is, well, I would say even today with the platforms that are so big, they change so fast, finding and retaining the right talent to be successful is challenging. And I guess the people are seeing the same thing with Gen AI.
Specifically, it's not exactly a large supply of talent in that talent pool. So,
yeah. And if you remember, it was probably a long time ago now, one of our early episodes, we talked about somebody made a comment about the annual salary for a prompt engineer, $300K or something. Maybe that relates back to the fact that there's not enough talent. So it's economics 101, right? Supply and demand.
Yep.
Yeah. I thought this was a little interesting. Enterprises are trending towards multi-model open source.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
I think that makes a lot of sense to me. There's going to be specialization that happens in this field, right? Even amongst the generalists. We're going to start seeing a lot more of the Mistrals, a lot more of the open source models out there, the llamas, right? Because Facebook is going to keep making them and open sourcing their older models, and I'm sure new ones will.
Yeah. The first sentence here, I think, is sort of really telling. Just over 6 months ago, the vast majority of enterprises were experimenting with one model, usually OpenAI, or usually two at most, right? And then you can see when they talk to them today, they're all testing, in some cases, even in production, multiple models that allow them to tailor to use case based on performance, size, and cost, avoid lock-in, and tap into advancements in a rapidly changing environment. So, yeah.
What does this say? What is this? It's about 60% of respondents are using 4+ models, approximately, if I'm reading that right.
Roughly, right? I don't know. I'm one. It's really funny. They're saying number of models providers use, one is zero. So everybody's using at least two models.
Right.
It'd be interesting to dive into this a little more, just to see sort of how people are using it. Like, I know last week I was talking about how I was jumping between different models just to kind of see, like, how did Claude respond to something versus, I think I was playing around with Llama as well, right? I was looking for speed and things like that. So yeah. I would assume a lot of that is kind of what's happening at this point, just to see how things are operating, right?
I think so. People are trying to find the best fit for their use case. So
they're
playing around with as much as they can. Of course, everyone's using OpenAI's model, it looks like.
Yeah. So you've got what? 100, which model providers are using? 100% OpenAI. And then Google would be what? Gemini. And then you've got Meta's Llama there, and then Anthropic and the others.
Yeah. Cohere at the bottom there.
Yeah. Well, and it makes sense because OpenAI was kind of the one that opened the door to all this. So
you
expect most people to still be using that.
They blew it wide open, right? So early adopter situation.
This is the thing that was most interesting to me. And you and I were talking about this sort of before we got onto the call, is this idea of open source models and how you can see here how it's changed in the 6 months. So we estimate market share in 2023 was 80 to 90% closed source, right?
Yeah.
With the majority of that going to OpenAI. Now, as the new response here, 46% are suggesting or saying they strongly prefer open source models for 2024.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is pretty interesting. I think there's something about thinking about maybe safety or liability, even, because who knows how this is going to evolve legally, right? Over the next couple of years, it could be an absolute quagmire. So if you want some protection, it pays a, I think it could pay off to diversify into some open source models.
Yeah.
Mind you, there's degrees of open source too, right? Some of them will fully expose the process, and some of them will only expose the weights. So.
Yeah. So it's going to depend on the model again, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see here what they're saying is, some of the respondents expressed targeting a 50-50 split, open versus closed models. So pretty interesting. And you can see here this next piece, and this goes to kind of what you just mentioned. Number seven is, while cost factored into the appeal of open source, it ranked below control and customization. And they've got this little graph here sort of showing why enterprises are selecting open source models.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense too, right? Because if you're using open source tooling, you have a lot more knobs to turn. You have control over the secret sauce, right? So
Yeah. But you've also got complexity with that.
Exactly.
So I guess like is always the case here, there's a balance. Finding the right balance is going to depend on a lot of factors, including something that's mentioned earlier in this article, is finding the right talent. If you don't have the talent to be successful, then probably going closed source, something from your chosen cloud provider, is probably the best way to go.
For sure.
At least the best way to get started, I would assume. And then you can, as you get a little more comfortable, you could start branching out and trying some different things.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you get the skills going, right? The upskilling.
Yeah, exactly. Control systems, right? Sensitive use cases, data security. That's pretty understandable. Fine tuning of models, So rather than building models from scratch, custom enterprise are looking for models that they can find too.
Yeah, that's the way. That seems to be the way. Oh, go ahead.
No, finish your thought. Sorry.
I was going to say, that seems to be the way things are going, because you generate this general purpose model that is very good at a wide range of tasks, and then you spec it down into your particular use case.
Yeah, well, and that actually is a good sort of segue into something that I was chatting with you yesterday in Slack. So I use Descript for all the video stuff, and Descript has its own AI now, and it will generate show notes and all sorts of stuff. So I basically went into Descript and I loaded up the previous edition or episode of this and said, generate me show notes for the podcast. And I've always been impressed. It's very good at doing that. And I thought to myself, just because I've been on, the bandwagon of Anthropic lately, I was like, I wonder if I took the transcript, dumped it into Claude and said, create me show notes for a podcast off this. And
sure.
I don't know if I shared them with you, but I was like, oh, yeah, okay. So that kind of goes to your point is I would say, I'm obviously pure speculation here, but Descript, to your point, has fine-tuned a model to do what most of their customers are wanting to do when they're using those tools, where Claude maybe is more, I don't know if it's the right word to use, but it feels like more of a general use type thing. Like, just doesn't have the knowledge to kind of give me the same types of show notes that I could get out of Descript.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it, right? Like, I'm sure you could fine tune the Claude model with enough context and multiple shot approaches to get something more in line with what you want. But as it is, it's just going to spit it. It's going to do its best with what it has.
Yeah, exactly. So this idea of not building custom solutions, but fine-tuning or augmenting your solutions with RAGs and knowledge bases and stuff like that, right? So it'd be interesting how that plays out. This one I thought was interesting. The cloud platform that you decide to use is generally going to determine which model you use. So first off, you can see here, almost 3/4 of people are hosting their models somewhere versus, let's just say 30% roughly are self-hosting. Okay. So they're either running those models on-prem or using GPUs from their cloud service provider. And then you can see if you are hosting your models somewhere, 52% of people are using models that are provided through their cloud service provider. Roughly 40% are using models from a particular provider. And then they've got some, a smaller percentage, 38%. That math isn't right, is it?
There might be some overlap, maybe.
I guess people are selecting multiple options, right? But really what this comes down to is, for the most part, if you're an Azure user, you're going to use OpenAI. If you're an AWS user, you're using Anthropic or Cohere. Cohere, I mentioned earlier, was, I've got this other model I wanted to try. This one has been on my list, Cohere, just to give it a whirl.
Right.
And compare it. And I just thought this was some more ammunition as to why I might want to go and try it. Because if it's making it in this list, it might be worth, doing some comparisons with it.
I wonder why this is. You know what? You can't access OpenAI on AWS, right? It's Microsoft only.
Think you can. It's Microsoft only.
Okay. Or probably if you're operating in Azure, you're going to leverage OpenAI, which is, people are agreeing, is probably number one, it seems.
Yeah. If you just kind of scroll back to one of these previous graphs, where was it? Right here, right? Mostly everybody is using OpenAI. So if you're on the Azure platform, it's probably baked in. If you're on any other platform, you're talking to OpenAI through some sort of custom integration, I would assume.
Right.
Yeah.
So for ease of setup, it makes sense that people would lean that way.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I kind of thought that was interesting. Where was it? Right in here, right? Just sort of how the platform is driving adoption based on the platform that you're on,
I guess,
versus something else.
Yeah, I guess it kind of speaks to how this system like their efforts to make it easier to set up access to these models are working for the cloud providers. So
yeah,
they seem to be the preferred way to do it.
Which makes a lot of sense, right? Because you can think of cloud providers as just a way to streamline deployment of complex software or complex solutions in a lot of cases. You let the provider, Amazon or Azure, whoever it is, manage all of the underlying complexity and you build on top of it. So it's sort of a natural thing then to have sort of the same outcome with complex Gen AI solutions, right? Why try to build it when you can just host it?
Yeah, exactly.
Early mark features. Yeah, I don't think there was anything else that... it says here currently... I made another note. I don't know exactly where it is in here, but this is it. Enterprises are building, not buying for now. So it'll be interesting to see sort of how the market changes over time. And they even say in here, much of what people are doing are simply GPT wrappers for the time being, building chatbots and stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out over the longer term.
Yeah, for sure.
And then the last little note here is internal use cases over external use cases. And this goes, I think, back to what we were talking about earlier on is just risk factors. They were talking in here about, you know, customers or organizations being concerned about security, right? Like information leaking out that they weren't intending to leak out, hallucinations and things like that. So they tend to be working with internal use cases or situations where a human is vetting what's coming back from the AI before passing it along to a customer or something like that. So I guess very similar to what we've talked about throughout this episode alone, but also in previous episodes.
Well, fair enough. And we've seen the results of what's what I'm looking for, uncautious deployments of this, right? Like
They actually refer
to call it out?
Yeah, they say
there you go.
Mishaps like the Air Canada service customer service debacle. So there you go, right? It's even making it into these articles, so it doesn't take long. Perfect. Well, any other final thoughts you want to share on any Gen AI stuff?
No, I think it makes sense. This was the Andreessen Horowitz report on AI. It seems like companies aren't necessarily sure what they want to be doing yet with it. They know they want to be doing it, and they're optimizing for options, it seems like. So they're diversifying.
Yeah. And where possible, grabbing some quick cost savings at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. As a quicker, easy win, and then trying to figure out what do they do after making some quick cost savings? How do we continue to show return on investment? So, that's another edition, long weekend edition in the books. Enjoy your long weekend. And be back next week with another weekly wrap-up. Take care for now, folks.
Yeah, take care.
Bye.